folks. So I thought I would comment on something that popped up during the recent election. Now that the dust is beginning to settle, you can kind of look back on it with a more of an objective view. And what I want to talk about is that Peter Hitchens seemed to come out, and it shocked a lot of people because he kind of de facto said vote for the Tory party, despite the fact that for years and years he's been saying no progress could be made in Britain until the Tory party was destroyed. And this caught a lot of people off guard and made a lot of people angry. A lot of people felt betrayed. And he turned on reform. He didn't express any kind of interest in them. I mean, I'm going to come on to that in a moment. And I thought, I'm sure by now people kind of know the law, because in our sort of corner of the internet, it's been a big thing for the last few weeks. And a few people asked for my opinion on it. Now, I want to say, I don't have any kind of Peter Hitchens never influenced me whatsoever in my thinking. But I also want to say that it's not really just about him. It's about a particular kind of conservatism in England in particular that I don't like. But they've always been there. You know, there's quite a few of them, and Hitchens is probably the king of them all. I think Starkey's like that to a degree, though not as bad. I was never influenced by it. It never really caught my sort of imagination. It never really got me going, and I think that's because I came in to the right through a nationalist pipeline, and so I didn't really come from a centrist position or a liberal position, and then drift across into a kind of standard English conservatism. More or less just went from being uninterested in politics to being a nationalist. As Nick Griffin, especially what he had to say, really resonated with me. And of course, all of these kind of English conservative types, they had nothing but contempt and hatred for Hitchens. And I think there was an element of that on display, and it still is, in the way that they're looking at reform. Now, this isn't a defense of reform either, by the way. Maybe some other time I could sort of have a chat about them. But what I noticed about the sort of the Hitchens thing was that I think it's actually consistent with this kind of style of conservatism, which is just useless. I think it's just absolutely useless. And when it kind of came down to it, for do we want to all take part in ridding ourselves of the Tory party once and for all, or sort of buckling down and going back into the same old finger trap of running scared of Labour? In the end, Hitchens decided, and I also noticed that Starkey was more sort of banging the drum of fear mongering about Labour to set us all back into that same situation which we've been trapped in. In the end, what we were trying to do with the zero seats thing was to try and escape this trap, escape this back and forth. And the counterpoint to that was that Labour, what scared these people, what made them kind of half-heartedly endorse the Tory party, was to say that, well, it's going to get much worse under Labour. And it just so happened, and Hitchens in particular was doing a full tour. It wasn't just like he was sending out some tweets or something. He was all over the sort of semi-alternative media. And he wrote this article in Unheard, where I think you can kind of get to grips with where he's coming from. And I want to say why I think it's wrong, and a waste of time and useless. And of course, he is this kind of, it's all over, flee the country. And I kind of have quite a bit of contempt for that mindset. I don't think it's of any use at all. And I'm somebody who's regularly sort of called black-pilled and doomer and all of this, but what I want to put into sort of perspective here is why I think this is a stupid and destructive mindset to have, which is no use, no good. and doesn't deserve attention. And in this Unheard article, he called it, he was basically why waving goodbye to conservatism. And he said, and this is him now, "I saw official London when it was still black and battered, a great imperial capital. I saw the Church of England when it still possessed majesty, dominion, and power. I saw on a sultry August day in 1960 the final astonishing relic of British global naval might, the Royal Navy's last battleship, towed to the breakers, a modern version of Turner's fighting Temeraire, is it? The scene, see, I'm too plebeian to understand what a word like that would be. The scene was made more melancholy when the colossal vessel, reluctant to die, grounded on the Portsmouth mud. A great lump rose in my throat, and I still feel a sense of deep, half-understood loss when I recall it." And he goes on for this quite a bit, and he's recounting this kind of twee nostalgia of a lost England, which I think many people, to be fair, I do that as well. We've all felt this loss. I don't blame him for that. And he goes on and he says, "Until quite recently, this country boasted of a kind of half-timbered theme park nostalgia for some aspects of itself, but this was pretty shallow. Nobody really misses all of those horse brasses and Toby jugs." We'll come back to the Toby jugs a little bit later. "That used to clutter our pubs, and the hunting enthusiasts, when it came to it, could find little support when the Blairites spitefully banned their picturesque, if bloody, gallops across the countryside. Great aristocratic houses are all very well for a day out, and I still share Evelyn Waugh's melancholy over their wanton destruction, but they are slipping out of the national consciousness, their original purpose and mystery, like most of our history." You can see here that it's all over. It's all the end. It's all done, and you will see the Blairites is the main villain of the piece, correctly, by the way. And he goes on, "It is almost funny that conservative media protests against the political correcting of the National Trust and the destruction of the statues for dogmatic reasons. Alas, most people under 30 have no idea what the fuss is about, as nobody has told them any history. The parish churches of England are an unmatched storehouse of beauty, and I fear for the future, for their future, as their congregations wither. For what does any young person make of them? They are written in a language as unreadable as Assyrian, and the stories they tell are of long ages, of which most of us know nothing, and I fear care less. Thus, the English countryside is a beautiful effigy of its former self, preserved by the last generation which understood it, but not at all guaranteed to survive much longer. The nearest thing to it, and it is not very near, is the populist nationalism now so strong in Poland and Hungary, and perhaps it will not be long before these countries are sending us civilizing missions of philosophers and parcels of books to see if they can revive or sustain the sinking fires of Christian conservatism in England. I doubt it. For we too, in the form of Noisy Nigel and his raucous followers, have decided to prefer the populist and nationalist path to the conservative one." I'll just leave that there. He goes on to wrap it up. It's basically saying it's all over, and all of this. But you will notice that there's a couple of things that I want to tease out in amongst all of that. And one of them is this sort of deification of institutions, whether it's the Royal Navy, whether it's the National Trust, whether it's the Church of England, the churches themselves, or even the pub and the pub decor. And what he's really getting at here is the loss of institutions. And this is why the Blairites are always the bad guys in this frame, again, correctly. And so, what he's really getting at here is that all of these institutions are now gutted, hollowed out, and worthless, powerless relics. And not much attempt was made to keep them in play, not much was attempt to respect them. And what's happened is that they've all been replaced by Blairite quangos and technocratic managerialism. And so, on the one hand, if you have as your sort of ethical backbone of the nation, the Church of England, what we now have or is like an NGO or the Equality Act or managerial HR departments. And he is right about all of this stuff. But what I take issue with is that this is actually the whole ideology of conservatism. In other words, I disagree with that this is the be all and end all. I disagree completely that this is the whole and not just a part. And I think one of the things that we have to address here is that demographics and the fact that the native people of Britain are in an existential situation. And to say that it's all over, to say that it's finished and there's no hope, is actually borderline treasonous because the people still exist. So he is completely correct, of course, that people don't go to church anymore. People are having their ethics and their morality formed by HR departments and the Equality Act and political correctness and all of this. So we now have new godless churches which have taken over. And if the only thing that you have any kind of sort of affection for is a gentler, more sophisticated, more morally sound country of yesteryear, then it's perfectly understandable that you'll just admit complete defeat. But the problem here is that we, the people, we're still around. We still exist. And so this is the issue that I have. And I think there's a perfectly sort of sound way to approach this problem is to just go back and think about the Toby jug for a minute that you mentioned in the article. And if you look at it, in the Toby jug, of course, it's a nice sort of beer pot or cup, which is adorned with almost like a statue and a caricature, a cartoonish face, and it's very flamboyant, it's very cozy, they're very nice and very traditional. This is, I can understand that it's nice to have these things in a pub, but and then we can contrast it to the plastic beaker. Basically, the plastic beaker is this kind of managerial technocracy. I mean, even the buildings even look like that. The buildings even look like just see-through glass and steel, transparent, whereas the Toby jug is weighty and heavy and nice and it holds well in the hand. And so this is out. And the transparent plastic, trashy, disposable beaker is in. And both of these things are structures. And the sort of traditional English conservative Toby jug is out, and the plastic cup is in, quite literally, in fact. But we can also see that this maps on to the changing nature of the institutions which govern us. Again, I agree completely with that. But both of these things here are missing something which I think is very important. And it's to ask the question, what is the function of each of these vessels here? What is the function of a Toby jug? What is the function of the plastic cup? And it is to contain something. It's to contain liquids, fluids. And this is what institutions are for. The people are supposed to live under institutions, but at the end of the day, they are something distinct and separate from it. The people, so you can take away the institutions, the people still exist. So we still exist now in the plastic cup and not in the Toby jug. The argument that you can make where all that matters is institutions, and if all of the institutions are gone, then that's the end. That's the end of your civilization is kind of rubbish because now the fluid, which is rapidly being blended and mixed out of existence, is in the plastic cup. And this is where the kind of English conservatism, which fetishizes over these old institutions, ends. It says, this is it, there's no hope any longer. And I find it just contemptible. I find it all quite repulsive, and irritating, because you're left in the situation of being high and dry and without anywhere to go to. And if we go back to the sort of scoffing nature of populism, what is populism then? Because you can say it's futile, it doesn't work, and all of the rest of it. But what that is that the people, literally the people, are angry. They're voting certain ways. They're voting against the regime. They are voting against the new institutions. But the problem is, in by its very nature, populism does not actually have any institutional backing, unless you get into containment, you get into people being sidelined on certain other issues and all the rest of it. But by and large, populism doesn't really have. It is a kind of plebeian mass against the elites, and it is also a rebellion against the new institutions. So then you get yourself this kind of the Hitchens right way of thinking begins to say kind of crumble in on itself, because the old institutions are now long gone, but what you have instead is this kind of incoherent and rudderless populism, but it does exist, and it's a sign that they are in revolt against the new institutions. And if you're then going to say, well, it doesn't matter anymore, it's all too late, that what do you how is it too late? How is it too late when there's like crimes? Do you just turn away from the ramp and sort of crimes on the streets and the quality of life like going down the drain? The people still exist, and they exist without their old institutions, which, as it turned out, turned out to be just completely feeble and useless at actually protecting them against this. You can say perfectly well that what they did was add to a gentler, more morally sound, kind of a metaphysical aura around the identity of being British. But at the end of the day, they were all swept aside, and they seem to have been swept aside quite quickly. But the people are still here. We didn't disappear with the institutions. The English people did not disappear because people stopped going to the Church of England each week. And what this reminds me of is a book that I read, which was a bit of a heavy-duty sort of theory cell kind of book, called Homo Sacer, Bare Life. There's a part of the book which stuck out the most to me, what little I could understand of it all, was where he sort of outlined what he meant by bare life. And a good way to think of this is if you think of a medieval city which has walls around it, there's three different modes of being that you can find yourself in. One of them is to be within the city walls and be protected by the sovereign power. It's all this sort of meditation on Schmitt and sovereign power and exceptions and Foucault and all of this kind of thing. And if you are within the city, the confines of the city, you are protected. And there's certain value placed on your life, even if you're going to be executed. Whereas the second sort of scenario you can find yourself in is that if you are outcast out of the city, which is an institution, and you find yourself on the outside of the walls, so you're in this kind of limbo where you're still you exist relative to the city, but not within it. Which, when you take into consideration this is about power, you are no longer entirely in one thing or the other. The third, of course, would be that where you are just off in the wilds, free, forming a new, under a new sovereign, or forming one of your own. But where we find ourselves when you are sort of without institutions to back you up is in the second scenario. Especially if you're native, if you're an Indigenous Brit, because you do not really have the backing of the institutions. You do not really have, by law, in fact, institutions which speak in your name. And in actual fact, we never did. If you go back and you look at it, or if they were there, they were swept away long ago. But it also stands to reason that if you view the institutions of the land, whether it's Parliament or the National Trust or the Church of England or fox hunting or all of these things. If you view all of that as the be all and end all of British identity, you can see that in actual fact, that means it follows that you can have people from all over the world coming in, and if they abide by those institutions, then they are just as British as you. It kind of slips its way in via the back door. So you see that even on this crucial sort of subject, they failed. They failed to hold the line on that as well. But where we actually find ourselves is being on the outside of it all now, quite blatantly, and as a matter of policy, if you look at things like the Equality Act. And so this is the lot that we find ourselves in. And it isn't the case that because we are not backed by institutions, and I'll say this again and again, that we what ceased to exist, that we kind of disappeared with the attendance of the Church of England or the belief that in parliamentary sovereignty, which is another thing that pops up quite a bit here, another reason why these people hate correctly the Blairite revolution is because power was taken away from Parliament, and in actual fact, that's what they fear will happen under Labour. And so where the Blairite project will be finished, and the basically more power will be moved away from Parliament, as if that would make any difference, as if they didn't just do whatever they wanted, as it stood now. But the problem I have with all of this is the assumption that what really needs to be conserved is institutions and not the people themselves. And so we end up in this sort of bare life scenario where the people still exist, but without institutional backing in any normal way. We live on the outside of the city walls. And it's very curious that this kind of English conservative mindset chooses that moment to say, well, it's all over. Tell your kids to flee the country, run away. There's no point in fighting it anymore. And then when the results of all of this are a kind of disorganized, sort of plebeian populist revolt, you then stab that in the back as well, because they are again by their nature in opposition to the hostile institutions. And the thing is, like, this is kind of where what I would regard as being the truth of the matter comes in, which isn't that institutions were hollowed out and we were betrayed and all the rest of it. That goes without saying. But what is the actual mode of being? What is the actual state that we find ourselves in? And this is the bleak picture that you have to look at, which is that you are then in a kind of Bakinski painting. It may seem a little bit overdone, but what you do find yourself in is where you live in a hostile environment without the backing of any institutions, but you do still exist. You live in a kind of desacralized, disenchanted world where your culture is just being trashed all around you. But again, you still exist. And you look around and you try to formulate some kind of resistance. And on the basis that the institutions, like the traditional institutions, are gone, the kind of nostalgia-ridden kind of Hitchens right takes that opportunity to stab you in the back and say no, even your revolt is illegitimate. Even as you wander outside of the city walls in this state of bare life, scratching around, don't get any ideas. And again, when you look, and if you think that, well, what it means to be England is to abide by these institutions of the land. And you'll see this as well, to believe in liberal democracy, to believe in Parliament, to be a Christian, or all of it is just superficial, whimsical, abstract rubbish. And I'm sick of seeing it, and I'm sick of it. It's useless to us. It's no good. And one of the reasons that I get accused of being a bit sort of disheartened and a doomer is because I've learned to kind of look at the harsh reality as it actually is, and then say, where do we go from here? This is the situation that we find ourselves in, is tantamount to a Bukinski painting. And if we're not there now, it'll come soon enough, or somewhere down the line, if things don't change, a drastic change as well. And so this is the point where a kind of real concrete reality hits about the lot of the people, which isn't as a grounding from where you begin your politics. It isn't in these whimsical institutions of yesteryear. It is in the sort of the hard reality of blood and guts people existing and scratching around and wandering around without institutional support. To say that this is the moment when we will just do nothing and go straight back into the status quo is quite repulsive. And it's tough to say, where do we go? Where do we go in an era of post-demographic dominance, post religion, post even nostalgia, deep into this kind of neoliberal technocratic world of numbers and widgets and insidious corporatization of everything. And instead of saying, well, okay, I'm cashing in me chips and I'm just gonna write doom mongering articles forever, like, I wish they would spend more time addressing like this problem that we have to face. But the problem is, here again, is that I'm approaching something which is crass and it's uncomfortable and it's a little what they might think of as racist or tinted with an era of the mid-century Germans, or it's crude to think like this. It's crude to say that we are a group, and we're in a bit of a bad situation here, and we need to look at it honestly and say, is it not a better foundation for your worldview to say that we conserve people, our people, and not institutions? So it brings you to the point where you can think, yeah, I understand it. I get it. It was better when all these older institutions were fully functional and dominating the country. Yes, it was. We can see it. We see the clips going around on the internet of London in the 1930s. We get it all. We get that it used to be nice in a country English pub. It actually still is. But the problem that we have to face is an uncomfortable one, and they just don't want to go there. They've cashed out. And then at the moment, then there's this kind of rebellion against the situation that we find ourselves in. They're there to stab you in the back. I've got nothing but contempt for it. I've got absolutely nothing but contempt for it. I think it's a cope. I think it's all twee nonsense. I don't think it's, I don't think institutions are worth sort of devoting your life to if the purpose of the institutions is to serve the people, not the other way around. So thanks for listening, folks. I'll catch you later.